Carol, welcome. Welcome to the Marie Curie Hospice here in Bradford. Thanks so much for coming up today. I'm working here at the moment as an occupational therapist. And as you know, I'm a BCBer. And we've got Dying Matters Week coming up. And at BCB, we want to do some proper, really open conversations about death and dying. And there isn't really a better place to start than your local hospice.
No, I'm delighted to be here and find out really what goes on in a hospice.
Yeah, what is hospice? What is a hospice? So from this hospice, we have an inpatient unit, a day therapy unit. We also do a lot of community work, and we have a lot of outpatients that we look after as well. So we literally take care of people right from the time when they receive the news that they're dealing with a life-limiting condition and they come onto that palliative care pathway, when we will look after them all the way through until the end of life. And then for the family members and the people who love them, the support goes on. I often say to people as they come into the Marie Curie world, if you like, I often say, we're in your life now, we're in your life. And once we're in, that's it. We stick around for as long as we're needed, really. But I wanted to show you around to give you a flavour. And the first person I want to introduce you to is actually Linda, who works on reception here.
Hello, Linda. Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. You're a receptionist here. And how long have you been here for?
I've been here almost 2 years.
And what's your job?
I'm the receptionist, so meeting and greeting, answering the telephone.
Now, you're a very cheery person with a smile. I guess that's quite important to have a way of welcoming people who must be quite daunted when they come in here.
Absolutely. I try to reassure people that, you know, it's a happy place. People come in and I just, you know, try to make them feel at home and make them feel comfortable and make them feel at ease.
And Linda and I were talking earlier, and of course, Linda, you're the first face that a lot of people see. So that smiley face with the sparkly eyes and, you know, jolly bright colour clothes as well, it's really important. But also you were saying, you're not just jolly, are you? You can work out when is the time to be sensitive.
Absolutely.
And,
There's a time when you know sort of if somebody's lost somebody or somebody's coming in and somebody's very, very poorly. So you obviously know how to react to those people. I can sort of sense who you need to sort of be a little bit quieter with, or you're a bit, hello, nice to meet you. And, you know, so basically it's just working things out as people come in, how I feel I should act.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Linda. Thank you.
Now, it would be rude not to say hello to Casey. So, Casey, can I introduce you to Carol from BCB?
Hello.
Now, Katie and I actually go back a very long way, don't we?
We certainly do.
But in terms of Marie Curie, I think it was about a year ago, and we had a lady who was coming towards the end of life, and the thing that was really, really worrying her was what was going to happen to her cat after she died. So obviously I thought of Casey, and as they say, the rest is history, isn't it? It
certainly is, yeah.
Katie, you're here with a very warm and friendly and cuddly-looking cat.
That's Carrot.
And that's Carrot.
It is, yes.
So what's Carrot's role here at Marie Curie Hospice?
So Carrot comes in and meets patients. He sits on their bed. He gives lots of cuddles, provides a familiar comfort as well.
See, as an occupational therapist, I would say what Carrots does is he gives people a chance to step back into that role of being a cat owner.
Yeah.
And sometimes often for our people, you know, dealing with a life-limiting condition, they're very, very poorly. They can't do it. But as Carrots comes along, and because he is the most placid cat in the history of placid cats, it gives people that chance to feel that I'm a pet owner again.
Obviously, there's a lot of evidence out there that cats have therapeutic values, both physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual as well.
Absolutely.
We come in, we may spend 10 minutes with a patient, we may spend 5 minutes with a patient, or we could be here hours.
Now, I can remember one particular gentleman, and you won't have forgotten this. You know exactly what I'm going to say now, don't you? It was a gentleman who was really disoriented and very, very unwell, and he was very agitated, and we were struggling to make his stay here as comfortable as we would want to. And he was a cat owner, and you came along with Carrots, didn't you? And what happened?
When we arrived, most of the nurses, the doctors, I think that were on shift, were sort of taken up with his care, trying to calm him down and make him more comfortable and less agitated. I just stood in the doorway with carrots on my shoulder. He lives on my left shoulder here. And I just stood there and he just looked at me, raised his eyebrows, and he just said, "You can all go now, Carrots is here." Well, we sort of understand now very difficult it is for people when they come in here and they're facing end-of-life decisions. And for a lot of people, they worry about the friends, the family, the children. But for many people, their biggest concern is their pets.
Especially if they live on their own.
Absolutely. So we come in, we'll meet with the patients, family if appropriate, staff members, find out as much as we can about their cat, which vets they're registered at, if they've got any needs, what the likes and the dislikes are. And then we offer at any stage, not just when they've passed away, but at any stage, we will offer to take that cat into our care. And I'm here today to see a lady whose cat came to us, but he's absolutely lovely and he's settling in really well. And I've waited till today because I want to be able to tell the owner that he's settled.
Okay, thank you very much, Katie.
Thank you.
So as Katie was saying, she visits the inpatient unit. She'll also come to the day therapy unit and she'll follow people up along the way. Now, here's a gentleman that makes a difference. Can I introduce you? Oh, he's running off. He's running off. Jonathan, can I introduce you to Carol from the radio station? Yes.
I'm maintenance, so we keep the thing working, make sure everything runs, and make sure everybody smiles at us and we're happy for them.
And I especially wanted you to meet Jonathan and maybe some of the others, because I think you're all in today, aren't you?
Yes,
everybody's
are.
In.
So you can go and talk to them.
This is one area, I think, if you're thinking what is hospice and you think about the people that make a difference, you've got your doctors and your nurses and, of course, your occupational therapists and all the rest of it. But actually, it is people like you, Jonathan, that make the massive difference. I made Jonathan laugh this morning because I told him that I appreciate working with him because he can work very nimble. And by that I mean when I ask Jonathan to do something that's going to make a difference to one of our patients, you can do it really quickly. And the sort of things that I might do are get him to pat test an alarm clock radio so that somebody, when they're very poorly, when they wake up in the morning, the thing that they see when they open their eyes is actually their alarm clock radio from home. And that can make a big difference. And you can do these sorts of things quickly, can't you?
We're not frontline with patients, but we do believe in what we're doing here. So, yeah, a response will work quickly for the patients.
And I guess people do bring in quite a lot of their things from home.
There's a little bit of that. No, it's not just that. It's also things that aren't right in the rooms or that need repairing and things like that.
And again, I think that's where your role is, I don't know, under-recognised maybe, not undervalued.
We don't believe that.
But some of the conversations that you can have with our patients, especially inpatients, are about ordinary things. Yeah. And I think the power of that when you're in an inpatient in a hospice is really, really helpful for folks, isn't it?
Yeah. We do focus on the patients. We enjoy having that knowledge that we are actually helping the patients.
Yeah.
And that's our prime mover, if you like.
And you don't need to know anything that's going on. You're just a human being sharing other human concerns with them.
Oh, yes.
Shall we? Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank
you,
Jonathan.
Good
to meet you.
See who else is around. Let's just see who's in day therapy.
Oh, I'm sorry to disturb your lunch here.
That in itself is quite an interesting moment, isn't it? Because
Lisa catching a dinner at her desk.
Exactly. How many times do you reckon you have dinner in the dining room?
Probably about twice a month.
So what's your job, Lisa?
So I'm day therapy sister, soon to be outpatient unit sister, and I kind of run all the outpatient part of the hospice. So my patients tend to go home every day, so they come on a daily basis. Maybe one day a week for a set amount of weeks, depending on what we've agreed on at assessment. So they will be referred to us via normally the specialist nurses or the GP or the consultant.
You know, the patients do come from all over. Some people come from the inpatient unit as well, don't they? But Lisa and I were talking earlier and talking about what it must be like for somebody when they get that diagnosis, that palliative diagnosis, and they get told that there isn't anything else that can be done medically.
Yeah, and I think from that, what people take from that is that they've kind of been written off, really. There's nothing else anybody can do for me, so that's it. I'm just going to be left to die. So we kind of pick them up at that point. So when they come to the hospice, they're frightened because the hospice is where you go to die, or that's what they perceive a hospice to be, and that they've been wrote off. So when they come to us, we have to change that mindset, make them understand that they're just transferring care. So we're specialists in palliative care. So they've not been dropped, they're not being forgotten about, they're not going to be left to die. Our job is to make sure that they live as full a life as possible, despite, you know, their illness. It's not just the nurses, there's patient family support that includes social workers, pastoral workers. We have occupational therapists, physiotherapists. We have an art tutor. And then we have psychology, so we refer pharmacist. To psychology, pharmacy. Yeah. So it's not just the nursing team, it's the whole hospice team, really.
So you're not just concerned with their physical well-being?
Absolutely not. Quite a lot of the time we look at people's emotional resilience and their well-being. And we also look at carers as well. So we don't just look at the patient, we look at who's around them, the family members, the carers.
And I guess some of the family and the carers have to be prepared to carry out things at home that maybe they've not done before, medical intervention,
yeah,
to a certain extent.
Quite a lot of our role is an educational, from an educational point of view. So teaching them how to do moving and handling, teaching about different equipment that might be coming into their lives. Because obviously, when somebody gets a palliative diagnosis, there's lots of things that come in.
I suppose like one example of that would actually be oxygen at home, wouldn't it? Because that's something that people who are struggling with their breathing, with COPD, or maybe with different forms of lung cancer. So oxygen going in is a thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so one of the things is what we get is patients that will come in that are on long-term oxygen at home. And when they come into us, obviously we've got strict guidelines that we have to follow. Whereas at home, you'll sometimes get a patient that will go, oh, well, actually, I go out in the garden with me oxygen on and I smoke. So what we have to do is educate them about the right and wrong way to use oxygen and what's dangerous and what isn't, really.
Anybody that's a specialist in palliative care, that's nurses, doctors, all of us, we all tend to work pretty holistically, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, we meet regularly on a daily basis. Before the patients arrive, we sit and discuss what's happened to that patient over the last week, because a lot can happen while they're at home. When they're on the ward, there's daily handover. But obviously, some of our patients don't come for a week. So it might be that we've got a week's worth of things that have happened at home, so we need to know what's happening because, like I say, lots of things have changed.
Lisa, thank you. And Laura, is it OK if I introduce you to Carol from BCB? This is Lorna Brass. She's a specialist doctor here working outpatients and day therapy unit. And I really wanted you to meet Laura because we're talking about Dying Matters Week at BCB, and we're talking about trying to encourage those conversations between everybody. And you were saying that for you, this doctoring isn't just about the patient. It's not even just about the family and their loved ones. It is actually part of that bigger conversation for you.
The bigger picture of that final bit, dying and dying well, has such a big impact, not just on the patient and the family, but the wider society, and being able to improve that.
Is that why you wanted to come to work in Marie Curie?
It was something I'd had an interest in from personal experience as a child, and the experiences that I had through the hospital those last few weeks I have along, that was where it could make the biggest impact with the smallest of things. And just being able to talk about what happens as you approaching death.
And have you always done this work?
Yes.
So you were driven to it by those?
I was interested right from before I started training. The more I did in training, the more palliative medicine appealed to me. It's that being able to make a big difference and a big impact, yeah, and make somebody's experience and their family experience some much better by just the tiniest of things and things that aren't particularly complex.
Yes.
Just the basics. Yeah. I think we've got the experience, we're more used to seeing what happens and dealing with all those emotions and things that come with it. I guess what we want to do is widen that experience so that it's part of everyday life. Yeah. Because it is. It can be difficult, and it depends on the individual person, and it's very much approaching it. It's talking about the choices and empowering them, getting them to think about that means that we can then, if they let us know, if they know, if they tell people what is important for them when they're dying, that because everybody's different with what's important. Some people, it's important to have family around. Some people, it's important to be in a place that feels safe for them. Some people, as long as they're comfortable and their symptoms are controlled. And it's looking at what is important for that person. It's a bit like, sounds a bit corny, but like a birth plan. Everybody's used to having a birth plan. And that changes as you go through the process. It's thinking about what would my ideal be, and then communicating that and letting people know so that we can do our best to try and make sure that that happens.
And I'm sure there are some people who are absolutely denying that they're not dying, or they don't want to know. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's respecting the person. Yeah. It's an option that they have to discuss their future care and what their preferences are. We're not going to force that on anybody. It's very much encouraging them to see the positives of thinking about it, but not forcing somebody to.
It's that balance, isn't it, between helping people to accept the reality of what's going on in a way that feels comfortable to them, but also supporting them to live to the maximum potential for as long as possible. And that's kind of what we do in a nutshell, isn't it?
Living as well as you can until you die.
Yeah.
So, Lorna, here we are outside in the garden area, which is beautiful. I'll just close the door here. Yeah. And this is a sort of walkway.
Well, it's a walkway, it's a wheelchair-friendly, even bed-friendly sort of pathway. And what we've got is a fish pond. We were talking about the therapeutic value of cats earlier. There's definitely a therapeutic value to just sitting, listening to water and watching the fish. And, of course, being an outside area, it's a good place for people who want to come and smoke. It's comfortable, it's beautiful, and it's very much part of the hospice, this outside space. Our new build is going to have even more lovely outside spaces.
I guess it's quite peaceful, a place to come, people come out and perhaps be on their own a bit.
It's funny because sometimes it is, and sometimes you get lots and lots and lots of people coming out here to be peaceful, and then it ends up with peals of laughter and all the rest of it going on. So it can go either way.
And where are we moving to now?
I'm going to go to the kitchen. I wanted to introduce you to Carol from BCB. And we're doing some programming for Dying Matters Week. And so talking about what actually is hospice. And I really wanted to introduce you because the food is a really big part of what makes the hospice what it is.
That's pretty kind of you to say that.
I'm not being kind. You know me, I speak as I find. I want to remind you of one particular gentleman that we have in common. And he was somebody who, the first time he came to the hospice, he felt really poorly and was actually quite afraid that he might be going to die soon. He left 10 days later. His diagnosis hadn't changed, of course, but he felt like, I've got a new chapter. I can, you know, I've got some more legs in me. And when I asked him what made the difference, he said it was the food.
My team and I are very passionate about what we do.
Mm.
I believe that my service is person-centred in that the first thing they do is they walk round the ward and speak to every single patient and tell them what's on the menu. We try and accommodate people's needs, be it ethnic or cultural or dietary type. We can do all the different varieties of. And so we go around and tell everybody we have a three-week menu cycle as such, but we then tailor it to fit in with people's appetites and try and get people eating. If they have a large appetite, that's fine. If we try and tempt people, it might be just soup and pudding. And it starts to get people then motivated in terms of like Lorna's saying about this gentleman came in, didn't want to eat, but once he started having the homemade soups, his appetite came back.
And the thing about this gentleman was yes, it was the food, but it was because it came without any sort of guilt, without any emotional burden. And as this guy was poorly at home and able to do less and less, he felt bad when his wife had to do everything. And that was another thing that made it difficult for him to eat. But here, he described the food as being a gift with love and no guilt.
We do that in terms
of...
We do that and we try and, as I say, we try and centre it towards people's cultural needs, appetites and own tastes.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And that is my vein, my team work the same way I do. I've been in healthcare for an awful lot of years, 40 plus.
And it's like with Jonathan, isn't it? Jonathan, who runs maintenance.
Yes.
You're not literally at the front, but you're definitely part of what makes hospice what it is.
We are all part of the big machine that's just a little cog in the big wheel.
Exactly.
But making the meals and making them interesting and making them according to the patient, sort of what they will eat, that must be quite time-consuming.
It can be, but it depends. I mean, at the end of the day, we've only got 16 inpatients. We have and can have up to 15 people in day therapy unit, and we try and tailor the two end services together.
And some staff and visitors and families.
It's not just patient meals. We just don't get to know patients. We do get to know patients, but we get to know visitors.
Yes.
And that is the compassionate bit in terms of what we do, because we can have. I'm not going to put names in the frame, but we had a chap who was here for about 6 weeks. And basically, he never left his wife. So he stayed in the hospice in one of the guest bedrooms or stayed with his wife, and we fed him for 6 weeks. And it was like, you get to know that person, you get to know them. I think that's part and parcel of what we do. The thing with this service as opposed to... I was the head chef at the Bradford Royal Infirmary for about 15 years, feeding 800 people. You can't get to know 800 people. I can get to know 16.
Yes.
And my staff get to know them, and we have that empathy with people, and we build up a relationship with them, and that's part and parcel of it. It's not just the food aspect of it.
No, not at all. It's the gift with love and guilt.
Well, we do give it. We do give it, and we enjoy doing it, and we take immense pride in doing that.
Yeah.
And that's just what my service is all about, and that's the way that we work as part of the team.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much. I've got something to look forward to.
Why? You're lucky enough to get
come in. I don't want to see you coming in, to be honest.
Okay, all right. But if I do, I'll come and say hello.
Well, we will look after you. That's Adele, one of my chefs, and she does exactly the same as I do. We all work part of the team, and we all sort of look after people and do whatever their needs are.
That's brilliant.
Thank
Gary,
you.
Gary is my other chef. It's nothing special. We don't think it's special. Other people think it's special, but we don't. It's just fulfilling a service need.
Brilliant. That's good to hear. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you
for talking to us.
Welcome.
Lovely. That's a nice, he said it's nothing special, but of course it is when you can have that sort of care for a small number of people.
So we're just going down past a bit more of the kitchen onto the inpatient unit, and I'm hoping that we might be able to catch some of the healthcare support workers, some of the nurses, and maybe even our Sophie. After you.
Thank you.
So, Kathy, thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time. Kathy is one of our healthcare support assistants here on the inpatient unit, and it's really, really busy at the moment, isn't it?
It is.
Yes, it is.
It's crazy busy.
Crazy busy.
So for people who don't know, what does a healthcare support assistant on an inpatient unit of a hospice, what do they do?
So our role is to assist the nurse with anything that she might need us to do.
Or he,
that's correct. So we are, firstly, a typical day would be making sure the patients are sat up, ready for their breakfast, hot drinks given out, assistance given for toileting, and then we help them with their personal cares, having a wash. But we're also there to spend time with them and talk to them should they need it. Making people laugh, that's very important, cheering people up, getting them out of their rooms,
lots of things, really. There's lots of things that a healthcare assistant does. So I arrived here as a member of the housekeeping team first, and there was a job opportunity to come onto the nursing team. So I applied for that, was accepted. So I've been here on the nursing side as a healthcare assistant for about 4 years, and I am now doing my nursing apprenticeship.
And when people are in here, I imagine the talking is one of the key things that they either want or need to do.
Absolutely. The patients tell us all sorts, anything and all sorts. You know, we're a shoulder to cry on, or they might want to tell us things they don't necessarily want to say to their family, or they might want our advice. So, yeah, there's a lot of talking goes on, and you need time for that talking to happen.
Thank you very much, Kathy, and good luck with whatever you decide to do.
Thank you.
So here we are in the inpatients unit, where it says laugh every day and love beyond word, which is, I think, very much the ethos here in the hospice. Would you agree, Lorna?
We have a lovely motto at Marie Curie, and it is hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. And actually, that's a very useful motto. It takes you through most things. Carol, let me introduce to you one of my medical colleagues. Imad, just for the sake of the radio piece for Bradford Community Broadcasting, for Dying Matters Week, would you like to introduce yourself to Carol?
Well, I'm Imad. I'm one of the specialty doctors in palliative care in Marie Curie Hospice. And I've been here for over a year, but I've done palliative care for quite many years.
And I especially wanted to talk to a doctor because one of the things that we're doing with this radio picture, What is Hospice?, is really having some very open discussions about death and dying. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to a doctor about is actually the dying process and the medical role in terms of managing that dying process. We've already heard about the idea of having a plan for death, similar to what you would imagine for a birth plan. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about the doctor's role in that, Imad, because it's a lot of what you do, isn't it?
Well, the doctor's role focuses on capturing the main problems that the patient faced during this critical time, and also families around that patient. And medically, there are the symptoms that we try to get them controlled as much as possible, but also we have to think holistically in terms of how the patient will they be able to communicate with their family. And sometimes that is achievable, but sometimes symptoms are too heavy and you have to use stronger medications which affect their communication. But the main thing is to communicate about what we're doing to the patient, if possible, and to the families, so that everyone is aware of what we're doing. And that's medically. And then also finding out what are the other aspects of care that we might get other people involved from the hospice.
And I guess people also fear pain, and that's something that you are able to assist with, isn't it?
Yeah, so pain, a lot of people feel that pain is something they have to have when they're dying, but that's not always true. The majority don't have pain, actually. Although in the hospice we see the patients that are in more need for management at this time because they have these symptoms. Otherwise, people die elsewhere, like in nursing homes or at home. They hope with no pain.
Certainly, as a colleague, the thing that I see you and my medical colleagues doing is constantly doing that juggling and balancing act between dealing medically with symptoms that you can help with, like the pain and the nausea and all sorts of things like that, and talking to the family and making sure that people are as awake as they want to be and as awake as is humanly possible.
Yeah, and then I have to add to this that one of the main issues near time of death is agitation, which can be for a lot of reasons, but some of them are at that stage are irreversible, which makes it hard to reverse the causes of agitation. But then we have to control the agitation, which means the patient will become more sleepy during this time, and this has to be clearly explained, and that in detail. That's why we can't reverse something. We don't make it happen earlier than it should be, and we can't make it, you know, delay it either. So everything happens normally, as far as I know.
We aim for a good death. That's what we aim for, isn't it? You know, when we have a review together as a multidisciplinary team after somebody's died, if as a team we can look at how that person died and feel satisfied that it's a good death, then we've done our job, haven't we?
Yeah, I think we see that reflected from families after the deceased person, they go away and they feed back to us that it was a very great experience they have in the hospice, and also that they will change their perspective, because a lot of families and people have different idea about what the hospice is and what they provide, and they have this fear inside before coming into the hospice.
Imad, thank you so much. I know we've literally made you running late now for a meeting, but thank you so much.
You're welcome, and I'm happy to help.
Thank you, Imad, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'll try and catch those later.
And here we are in the ward manager's room, where it says, do the best you can until you know better, then when you know better, do better, by Maya Angelou, which I think is great. And obviously the team Bradford value is up on the wall here, working together with kindness, care and commitment to create a community which values everyone. And that person-centeredness is very much part of what's going on here.
Introduce you to my colleague Sue Oxley.
Hello, Sue.
She's a physiotherapist here. I've just watched her going zooming down the corner. Have you got 2 minutes just now?
Go on, as long as it's 2 minutes.
Just 2 minutes, Sue, to tell me what it is that you do here and what are some of the issues that you face working here in palliative care?
Right, I'm one of the part-time physios that works here. There's a couple of us, so we cover the whole week, Monday to Friday. And our role is in rehabilitation of palliative care patients, and that may sound quite confusing to some people, but our aim is to try and enable them to have the best quality of life that they can, and that may involve being able to get them back up on their feet again, providing appropriate walking aids for them, ensuring that they're safe.
And we work very closely together, obviously Sue as physiotherapist and me as occupational therapist. So I always describe my job as being about helping people with getting from one end of the day to the other. So that's all the things that people have to do, like getting up, getting washed, getting dressed, practical stuff. And then also the things that matter, the meaningful activities that make a day a better day. And we work together really closely, don't we? Because sometimes it's okay deciding what you're going to do, but how you're going to do it is very often where the physio comes in.
And that's one of the good things that working in the hospice, we do work together as a team and to provide sort of holistic care for the patient.
And we work with all sorts of people, don't we? All ages, all diagnoses. It can be anybody.
It's not just cancer patients within the hospice. We've also got an awful lot of neurological patients, people with progressive conditions that are going to deteriorate over the time, people with heart failure, people with chronic chest conditions. Yeah, yeah.
So when you said it's rather strange to be talking about rehabilitation, is that what the patients themselves feel or their families?
Often the families, yes. They might think, why is the physio coming to see my relative or whatever?
Sometimes every day with an exercise regime, but it can make a big difference, can't we?
Yeah. And we'd see not only inpatients as well, we also see patients that come for day therapy, so we see them as outpatients as well.
Great, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sue.
Thank you. And that was a perfect in for telling you a little bit about what I do as well, because my role is that little bit different. It's all about supporting people with the activities that really matter with them, and that is completely different with everybody. And my job can involve things as diverse as negotiating a free football package on a television for somebody for whom their most meaningful activity is watching the football on the telly and it's all gone wrong, right through to ringing the council about noisy neighbours and everything in between. It's whatever is going to support our patients with having the best best day they can possibly have.
That sounds like a fantastic, rewarding job, Lorna.
Do you know, it is. It is. And there is definitely something about being a woman of a certain age and just not taking no for an answer when I'm doing things on behalf of our patients.
So and yet, I guess that's really, really important for people in the last days or months of their lives to be able to have the things that they really, really want.
Yeah, it's vital, yeah. And it's, as we were talking with Laura, sometimes it's those things that are apparently quite small. Actually, if they make your day a better day, they're huge. Carol, we've got one of our Marie Curie charity patrons in the building. Come with me, come and meet a patron and we'll find out what they do.
So, tell me who you are.
My name is Christine Hamilton-Stewart and I'm patron of the Marie Curie Hospice in Bradford. Being a patron is a difficult thing to describe. I am a volunteer. I have been a volunteer with Marie Curie for 25 years. I trained as a nurse and I'm married to a doctor, so palliative care and looking after people is really embedded in my life and always has been. The reason I spend a lot of time volunteering for this hospice and the Marie Curie nurses around our region helping patients is I really believe that we are the organisation that puts its arms around people and looks after them during the most difficult days of their life.
That's fantastic. But at what point did you become a patron and what made you be a patron and why? What's the job about?
Right, the job. 25 years ago, I received a telephone call from Marie Curie in London telling me that they were going to build a hospice in Bradford. I'm not quite sure why they telephoned me. Somebody had suggested that they did. I think because I'm part of a long-standing Bradford family who had volunteered for various things. I chaired a small committee of local influential people and we were asked to raise £1 million. There were not good days in Bradford. We'd had difficulties with the Bradford football stadium fire. We'd had race riots, 7 PLCs, that's businesses had left because Bradford was not thought to be a good place to be. I knew it was a very good place to be, and I also knew that Marie Curie was a very wonderful and important organisation. So with the help of some amazing, generous local people, we raised £3.5 million in about 18 months to build this hospice. So after that, I thought my job was done. But what I have learned over the next 20 odd years is the job is never done.
Do you remember me saying, Carol, that I say that with Marie Curie, once we're in your life, we're in your life. I think that's happened to you.
Yes, that's certainly happened to me. I do think that it is an extraordinary caring organisation who has the capacity to change, ever change with the changing times. The service we provide is very different from what the one that was envisaged 25 years ago. Only about half of our patients now have cancer. The other half have lots of different diseases, conditions. We're all going to die, but some sooner than others. But we, as an organisation, constantly look at what we should be doing, how we should be doing it, what is the best way to care for the patients. And unfortunately, at the root of all that lies fundraising and the money to do it. And my role within the organisation is to be, as a patron and ambassador, to talk to people, to talk to communities and groups, tell people what we do, and also take my part in fundraising and achieving significant donations of money to help us to do that.
And you've obviously done very well because you've got a rebuild here, a refurbish, which is going to be amazing.
Yes, I'm part of a very small but beautifully formed group called the Yorkshire Development Board. And about 2 years ago, Marie Curie said, come on, we need to do this. Could you find us £1.5 million? And it really was, oh no, not again. How are we going to do that? But extraordinarily, the people of Yorkshire and some very successful and philanthropic businesses have come into play. And once again, we've got the money. And we are bucking the trend for the region and nationally for Marie Curie, we are very successful in Bradford. And I think part of that is the wonderful people and care that this hospice gives.
Thank you very much, Christine Hamilton-Stewart. And let's hope that when it comes to the opening, formal opening, that you'll invite BCB back to be part of that opening.
We would love it. I hope you will come. It'd be a very special day and we look forward to it and to celebrate the great work that the local people are doing.
Thank you very much.
Now, another person you really need to meet, Carol, is Leslie. Her job title is ward clerk, but she does so much more than clerk on the ward. So come and meet Leslie.
So, Leslie, your role here is ward clerk. Give us, I suppose there's no such thing as a typical day, but what might you be engaged in doing?
From admissions to a patient, from the minute they come through the front door to the actual discharge for the patient to go home, in cases a lot of patients do go back home. So it's great meeting and greeting with the patients and the relatives, settling them into the room, making sure they're all... the information that we've got is correct, next of kin, updating on system one, to then all appointments and ambulance bookings and sadly in a lot of cases for the funeral directors to liaise with them so that the collection of the bodies would go to the funeral directors. Discharges from start to finish on the discharge to make sure that everything's complete for everybody, all the team, that everybody's little bit of work that we all goes together in the pot then and everything's ready for the discharge, and then I'll make sure that they get the transport home on the discharge and just make sure that all the boxes are ticked for them to go on for a safe discharge.
But that's not really the half of it, is it, Leslie?
No. I can't.
No.
If I started, I'd never stop.
Tell us about the really special days. I mean, as an occupational therapist, I'm all about meaningful days and what matters to you.
Yeah.
And I think often you get very involved where we've got almost like a crisis of a special day that's got to be sorted out really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And that's where Leslie really steps into her own. And I know that there was a wedding that you knew about, Carol, that you were heavily involved in.
Yes. Anything from a birthday party to maybe a picnic in the garden or a conservatory to a wedding to a christening. I get involved from start to finish with that. And we had a couple that had been together for a lot of years and never married. And she became really, really poorly really quickly and accepted his proposal. So we'd really 24 hours to get this wedding sorted, which we did do. The registrar came to the hospice, and because they were eco-friendly couple, that they wanted really, if they could, to have the garden in the wedding, but obviously the registrar couldn't do that because it wasn't a place for a licence. So we actually brought the garden into the conservatory for him. So we put a massive gazebo up and brought a load of plants in from outside, put fairy lights, put chairs, and it looked absolutely stunning. And that's where they actually got married. And it was a lovely, lovely afternoon. We got her down there in a wheelchair and then she managed to say her vows and they had a lovely afternoon and a tea then with the friends. So nothing too big or too small, you know, I get involved in, and we can turn a wedding round in a full day that if we need to do, and we've done that on many occasions.
That's fantastic, Leslie. Thank you very much for telling us that story. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
That's perfect. Carol, I wanted to introduce you to Salma. Salma is a pharmacist here at the hospice, and I wanted especially to talk about the role of the pharmacist here because when people think of pharmacist, I don't know that they would necessarily think hospice. They're more likely to think big high street chemist, aren't they, really? And the work that I see you doing every day around and about on the ward, talking to patients and all of that, is quite different from what you'd see a high street pharmacist doing, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. So a high street pharmacist would be involved with patients in the community, whereas obviously I work with patients that come to the hospice. So there's two parts to my role. I work both on the inpatient unit and in our day therapy unit. So with the day therapy patients, I have regular medication sessions with the COPD group and with patients who have
That's
heart
the
failure.
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease group.
Yes. So, yes, so I do regular medication sessions with them and I just discuss the types of medications that we would commonly prescribe for those conditions, and we discuss any potential problems that they might have, be it side effects or be it just simple things like how to manage their medicines and keep on top of them, which can be quite common with patients. So it's nice to be able to work with those sorts of patients and iron out any issues that they might have or just be able to help with that. Now, on the inpatient unit, my role is slightly different. So because the patients have been admitted into the hospice, the first step that I take is to assess what medications they've come in on. So I do what I call a drug history. So that's basically identifying what medication the patient was taking exactly prior to admission. I then work alongside the doctors and nurses throughout the whole of their stay just to make sure that their medication is optimised and that we are using all the appropriate medication for them, and then equally on discharge, once again looking at how they have managed their medicines prior to them coming in and being able to help sort out any issues that they might have.
And I think that's key. I mean, lots of people have mentioned how the inpatient unit is very much about discharging people back home, isn't it? People will come in feeling quite rubbish, have that specialist treatment for a few days or weeks, and then go back home again. And obviously the diagnosis hasn't changed, but they can go home feeling much better, able to have a better day once they get home. And I think your role especially is very key in this, because we will say to Selma, Selma, it's 9:30 in the morning and they've changed their mind. They do want to go home. Can it all be ready by 3? And that happens quite a lot, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely. Obviously, with the nature of these patients, things can change quite rapidly. So that includes the medicines that they're on as well, which then for me... So I think it's quite useful for the hospice to have a pharmacist. So yeah. I've only actually been in post about just over a year. So prior to me working, there was only pharmacist in port 4 hours per week, so it's quite a big difference for them as I work full time. But I think for the hospice generally, it's been quite useful just because of the nature of the patients and the amount they change in their medicines. It's quite useful to have someone on board and being able to help sort out a patient's discharge pretty quickly.
And I imagine it's quite a fulfilling job for you too.
Absolutely, yeah. So palliative care is not something I've had extensive input in, but it has been totally new for me and it's been really good. So it's been very challenging, I must admit, but it's been very rewarding as well, just being able to see the change of a patient from when they first come in and, you know, they might have been really anxious or something, but then being able to have that input and help them out with their medicines and give them that confidence in being able to manage their medicines when they go home, which will help quite significantly considering the stage of their condition.
Great. Thank you very much, Selma. You're doing a brilliant job here, by the sounds of it. And thank you very much for talking to us at BCB Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
OK. So, Carol, I'm really happy to find that Naz is in the building. Naz is one of the busiest people in the history of busy people. And I wanted you two to meet, because we're painting a picture of what is hospice. And I think your role is really, really key in that picture, especially for Bradford Hospice. Now, they call you palliative care liaison worker. What does that actually even mean, Naz?
Good question, really. So, I mean, if you just take the word liaison, I suppose I'm the liaison between patients and service providers. So that's kind of where I see myself. And I'm employed by 3 organisations, so that's quite unique. So I work with Bradford District Care Trust, who hold my contract, but they also jointly employ me with Bradford Hospitals Trust and Marie Curie. So the reason behind that is they, all 3 service providers are the palliative care service providers in Bradford District. They provide services to the same patients. So it's the same patients that use all 3 services. And the people that I work with tend to be from a South Asian background. So when I'm working with them, it kind of enhances continuity of care. So if I've met somebody at home, and then we've instigated an admission to the hospice, I can follow them up in the hospice, and quite often I would know a history of what's been going on, what the issues are, whether they're physical, emotional, or otherwise. It makes it easier in terms of trying to deal with a particular issue that somebody may have, because I've already quite often got quite a lot of history.
So very person-centred then?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's all about the person, really. So, you know, we obviously, as you know, in palliative care, it's about treating somebody as an individual. It's all about holistic care. So whatever the person is, it's not just about their physical problems. It's about some of the other issues that they may have. So, for example, it could be that somebody may have an issue with housing. They may have some financial issues. They may have problems with their employment. Quite often we're supporting people with grants to help them financially, putting them in touch with people that can support them for welfare benefits, and even supporting people to apply for applications to bring somebody over from another country, so that somebody could be dying and they're too ill to travel, so we're supporting them with visa applications. So every day is different and we get involved in all sorts of things, you know, even supporting families in getting children into schools that they wouldn't otherwise get to.
And are you known in the community?
Not necessarily. I think because of this job I'm known by various people that work in the community. And I've been doing this role now for 19 years. So I've met many families from on more than one occasion where they've actually, quite often actually, people have contacted me directly and asked me, can we get involved with their family member who's now currently ill? Quite often when somebody gets a cancer, I get a telephone call and then I point them in the right direction. If they are palliative, then we would normally have a conversation about kind of what their needs are and usually request that they discuss it with their GP, who can then make a referral to us. Some families have made self-referrals because it's been appropriate, and we've then got in touch with our GP practice as well.
And are there sort of special things that you have to think about in terms of religious difference or cultural differences or language difficulties?
I mean, in Bradford, yes, quite often there are challenges when it comes to language. So although I work with the South Asian population, a lot of my colleagues now are finding the same challenges that they had 20 years ago with the South Asian population are now the challenges that they're having with newer populations. So, for example, the Eastern European populations in Bradford. One of the nurses that I work with in Bradford, Barbara, in the district, a lot of the people that she usually supports are from an Eastern European background, and we quite often have discussions about some of their challenges and issues, which are actually very, very similar to when the South Asian populations first became established in Bradford.
And I guess that must be very useful then for everyone concerned, but on both sides, both the people that you work with, but also the staff, to have an understanding of what some of those issues are.
Yeah, so quite often once we get over the language barrier, there are often some cultural issues, and they can either be culture related to where somebody comes from. So it could be, for example, we talked about the Eastern European population, and quite often people from other countries, we sometimes forget that their health care experience is different to ours. So somebody may come from a rural background where there's no hospitals, there's no GP practices and there's no district nurses. So if they are diagnosed with a cancer or a heart condition, which is regarded as an extremely serious condition, you would go to the hospital. You would not be treated kind of by anybody locally within your village. So when people come to this country and they are not well, they're not used to going to district nurse to see their district nurse or to see their doctor. So quite often their first point of contact is A&E. So they will go to the doctors when somebody's come back from work or come back from school, and quite often that means going to A&E. So we have to try and address these kind of issues. Quite often people have got cultural differences in terms of talking about death. So it's not the done thing, it's a taboo thing, and you would only deal with and talk about death when somebody is actually terminally ill, then they are dying and it's obvious that they are dying. That's the point in which you would plan and talk about someone's death. Planning and talking about it earlier on for some people is quite challenging. And myths, so quite often people think, or coming to a hospice means you actually come into the hospice and you'll be coming here to die. So again, it's about talking to somebody. Another things that we do really well at the hospice in terms of individualised care, again, if you think about the Muslim population in Bradford, which is quite significant, it's actually a good place for people to come to be cared for symptom management and also to die. because people, when they die here, everything is done quite quickly in terms of providing death certificates and supporting people with speedy funerals and burials.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you very much, Naz. That's a real valuable role that you play. And I can't help thinking that a lot of other patients could well value that sort of role to talk about those things that you've been talking about. I don't think it's necessarily just an issue of South Asian patients. Yeah. But thank you very much, Naz, for that. Thank you.
So, Carol, I want to introduce you now to Nikki Dembo. We're very lucky she's in the building. She's a very busy woman, and she is our lead nurse. So her role is kind of holding the whole thing all together.
I think that in terms of the hospice movement, I think hospices are changing. The environments of hospices are definitely changing. The purpose and requirements of hospices are changing. I think that our patients and families value the hospice as a place to come for efficient and effective care, so management of their symptoms through their illness. But also, I think it's wider than that. I think our patients and families use the hospice to bridge that gap, really, which often they experience a gap in the care services. So they've had a period of quite intense treatment over quite a prolonged period of time, and often when they are approaching the last stages of their lives, maybe their last 12 months of their life, there is a requirement for that safety net to be in place. And I see that the hospice plays a part in that safety net. It's not the be-all and end-all. Lots of patients want to be at home in their community, but I see the hospice as an opportunity to be that safety net in terms of provision of really efficient and effective symptom management, but also around starting to tackle some of that advanced care planning. And by that I mean having those difficult conversations, bringing families and friends together, being able to talk about some of those issues and concerns that can often be quite challenging and to tackle.
What do you mean by advanced care decisions?
I think patients and families, I think it's really important that they get an opportunity to think about what they want to happen. It's their destiny, it's their life, and it's their death. And it's important that they have an opportunity to talk through what that means to them, what emotion that provokes, and to have a safe, supportive environment where they can unpick some of that and what it means. Quite often a lot of our patients will question their whole being in the last few weeks and months of their life. You know, they will look back and reminisce on their life, and not all of it is rosy. So they want to make amends quite often and sort out problems and challenging relationships that they may have had. And I think some of it is around them starting to plan so that they get the death that they want. And there's something in there around them being able to remain in control of their own destiny and have those conversations with the people around them, the people that love and care for them. And that for them helps them, really, because that helps them prepare their relatives and friends and carers for life without them, the future. And some patients find that quite cathartic, knowing that they are helping to prepare their own loved ones for what life will look like as they go forward. And all of those things, you know, as well as all of the practical issues that need sorting out, you know, access to benefits and access to equipment and all of those things that make the last few weeks and, you know, months and weeks of life easier or less challenging. I think that if we, as the hospice, if we can connect all of that joined up working and help to support, make that happen and support patients and families to move through that bit of the journey, then, you know, that is the strive towards the good death that everybody wants, really, and deserves.
So, Carol, that's it now. You've seen the Marie Curie Hospice here in Bradford. What did you make of it?
I thought it was a great place, and I think what I've come away with is thinking that this is a place where I can live well before I die.